All right, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Kevin Randall, your stories, your questions. I want to shy away from just lights in the sky, but if you saw something truly significant, check in with us on that as well. Kevin Randall with us. Kevin, what about the hard evidence that so many people have been seeking to try to convince all of us that UFOs truly do exist? What's
up? There are examples of that. Ubatuba, Brazil, from 1957, there was bits of UFO that was seen to explode in the air that made it into the United States. The problem is the chain of custody of that debris is broken. So we don't get it from the beach where it was picked up into the hands of the people here in the United States directly. We have a split there. They don't know who picked it up and sent it to the guy who eventually brought it to the United States. The interesting thing, or the funny thing about that is, some of that debris ended up at APRO headquarters, and APRO sent a small segment of it to the United States Air Force, you know, cooperating with the Air Force so they could analyze it. The Air Force wrote back and said, "We've inadvertently destroyed the sample without getting a good spectroscopic analysis. Could you send us another piece?"
Huh.
I'm thinking, you know, getting a bit of alien spacecraft is really a tough proposition. You clowns burned it up without getting any valuable information on it. I'm not sure I want to trust you with the sample again. The sample now is in the hands of Peter Sturrock, so there may be some interesting stuff going on there. There's all kinds of photographic evidence, which, of course, it's sort of an indirect evidence. In today's environment, you know, a 12-year-old kid with a camera can make an incredibly good faked film of a UFO. I've always said that 99% of the photographs taken of UFOs were taken by teenage boys. 99% of those are faked. And it seems that every time we turn around, one of these photos that had appeared in the 50s and 60s, it was taken by a teenage boy. They've come out and said, yeah,
I faked it.
They faked it. Well, with the exception of the Lubbock lights. And I talked to the guy, Carl Hart Jr., who took the pictures of the lights over Lubbock, Texas, the V-shaped formations back in 1951. I talked to him in the mid-1990s. He was in his 60s at the time. And I asked him about that. He said, "I still don't know what I photographed." So, I mean, there's some that fit into that category very, very well.
What do you think of the Billy Meyer case, the fellow in Switzerland, one arm, taking years ago, before we had Photoshop on computers, incredible UFO pictures?
Incredible pictures, but the evidence surrounding that whole thing just doesn't seem to hold up. I mean, he's in the realm of the contactees, George Adamski and George Van Tassel and those guys. I just don't find that very credible, and I hesitate to say that because I know there are people who, you know, swear by those photographs. I just don't find the evidence and the testimony surrounding it to be very credible.
All right, let's go to the phones for you. JP is in St. Louis. He's to the Rockies. JP, go ahead.
Good morning, George, and your guest.
Morning.
On your show. I love the show. I got a comment and two quick questions.
Sure.
The comment is you know, I'm from the school of thought. From when I think about this, I know UFOs, there's something. They're about something. It's real. But what is it? And I think that it is probably demonic because just the Bible shows there's that famous painting, I think it's in Italy. It shows the crucifixion and the three crosses, and in the background is these two teardrop aerodynamic things in the sky. One's chasing the other, and they seem to have their hands on the control. So that seems to tie it in with the Bible, plus Ezekiel. And what's the, you know, it's the game plan is to fool mankind. That's the whole game plan of this hide and seek thing. Why they're here? No, we're over here. And so my question would be, well, if they're really from interplanetary, why wouldn't they go right to a space station up to this that we had, and they'd be able to detect that there's humans inside? Why wouldn't they pull right up there? And the second question is he's been to the ranch or whatever that was in Roswell. Even though the Army supposedly came and picked everything up, wouldn't there be micro, if you took a real sophisticated metal detector, wouldn't there be micro bits of some of that debris still there in the soil?
I would disagree with you on the demonic aspect of it. I think that we may be operating with sort of the prime directive. They don't want to interfere with our development, our society, which is why they haven't revealed it ourselves. I mean, they could have landed at the White House or in New York City or whatever and said, yes, here we are, here's what we can do. I really don't know what the motivations of an alien race would be, so I really can't answer that question. We have performed at the ranch in Roswell. Not only do we use metal detectors, we performed a archaeological site survey, which was the digging of 24 test holes with the shaker boxes and an analysis of the materials there, including chasing down burrows of various rodents that would have a habit of carrying these shiny things into their burrows. And a much larger archaeological survey was done about 10 years ago through the University of New Mexico. So it's been looked for. We've tried to find the microscopic bits that would show something had crashed there, and we have not had any success in that.
Not at all. Not at all. Kevin, in terms of other ufologists outside of the United States, are there many?
Oh, certainly. I communicate with them all the time. I hesitate to keep saying in my newest book, but
it is.
For the Ghost Rocket chapter, a fellow in Sweden was very helpful with that, and I've communicated with a number of people in France and Italy, Australia, Thailand. So, yeah, it's a worldwide phenomenon, and with the Internet, we're all able to connect much better than we used to be able to. We now communicate with what's going on in various countries and what the skeptical community is doing, what the believer community is doing. So, it's a worldwide phenomenon. There's a great deal of interest throughout the world.
We go to Tim driving around in Indiana on the wild card line. Tim, go ahead.
Good morning, sirs. How are you all doing?
Very good, Tim. Thank you.
Good. My question is, during World War II, of course, the German World War II Bell, was it ever captured intact, or did it make its way to South America along with the rest of the German officers?
And Hitler.
I'm not real familiar with that area of research, so I really can't comment intelligently on it.
Okay, we'll check into that, though. We've done some other programs. I think it was intact. I don't know where it is now, though.
I've seen a documentary with some of the remnants of one of the testing facilities, but like I said, I just haven't had an opportunity to delve into that in any great depth.
Yeah, they called it the Nazi Bell primarily, and some say, hey, it was a myth. Others say it was real. It was supposed to be some kind of particle accelerator.
I just really don't know anything about it.
We'll check into that. Okay, let's take some more calls. First time caller Thomas in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Hey, Thomas, thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning. I enjoyed y'all's commentary, and not to take away from him, I had a sighting in 82, and I was on a Sunday coming across the street, and I saw some power lines, and I saw that this object that he was talking about, and metals were metals that I never saw before, and it had a glowing top, and as soon as it charged off the power lines, it stopped. It was moving like a circular motion, and it went to a parallel and stopped again at a pretty decent speed, and then it switched course and shot up again to about another parallel and stopped, and then the last parallel at the third, it shot out of sight, and what I saw, I know, was real. It was Sunday, and it didn't want anything to do with me. It was very, very, very negative towards me, didn't want anything to do with me, and whatever this gentleman here is stating is 100% correct, because I believe in what I saw.
All right, thank you. Good observation as well.
But it's interesting, too. One of the last unidentifieds in the Project Blue Book files is from a fellow in Texas who had sort of a same reaction to the to a UFO that he had seen. And the Air Force originally labeled the case as insufficient data for a scientific analysis, which was a way of them not having to explain a case. And he wrote in and asked what information they needed, because he had supplied everything he could think of that they would need. And they finally changed to unidentified, but he had some kind of a similar reaction to seeing a craft in the sky.
Do you remember some of the other old-time reports of a craft in New Guinea? A missionary saw, you know, ETs waving at them and things like that. It was strange stuff.
Yeah, that was a Father Gill sighting. And
yeah,
that was one that Hynek investigated at length, by the way, and he was always very impressed with that sighting. But you know, there's all those sorts of things. And one of the things I found interesting is early on in the late 40s, early 50s, when they would report a creatures associated, they were normally wearing some kind of spacesuit and apparatus on their back to help them breathe. And as we move forward in time, that sort of thing disappeared, and you ended up with them in kind of a flight suit or flying garbs and that sort of jumpsuit type of thing without the breathing apparatus. But it just sort of as if they either got used to our atmosphere, found a way to breathe it, or it's a different group that's showing up that could breathe our atmosphere.
Okay, take a few more calls here before the break, and then we'll come back with more. Christian in Los Angeles, and now he's on Coast to Coast. Christian, go ahead.
Hey, George, it's good to talk to you again. I'm always happy that I'm able to get through. Hello,
right.
Kevin. How are you, sir? And thank you for your service.
Thank you. Thank you.
I've noticed that, one thing I want to ask, do you still stay in contact with Donald Schmidt? Because both of you really dove into investigating Roswell early in the 90s. But I wanted to ask and get your comments, what you think about this. There was a show that came on just recently. It's called Hangar 18. And to make a long story short, this one episode discussed what sitting presidents, since Truman to the present day, know about UFOs. And Truman knew everything because, as you know, Roswell occurred on his watch. Eisenhower knew everything because of his seniority both in the military and as president. He knew a great deal. I think Kennedy probably knew some, but not everything. But it seemed to point out that the president who probably knows this just as much, you know, who is very secretive, is President George W. Bush, or Bush 41. As you know, he also worked for many years with the CIA. He has connections with the military-industrial complex, and he's been extremely a very secretive individual. In fact, when Carter, when he was president, asked Bush, when he was the CIA director, that I want to see the UFO files, Bush's response was, well, sorry, you're not in the know, and it's all compartmentalization, and, you know, you can't see it. But how do you feel about that? Do you think Bush, and also the show seemed to allude that he might actually be or may have been an advisor or a member of Majestic 12? And I'll wait for my answer. And thank you very much. And keep writing more books, for heaven's sake. Don't stop.
Don't stop, Kevin. Go ahead.
Well, then buy them quick so I can afford to write more of them.
That's right.
I think you're right that Truman knows. But the one thing about Eisenhower, you have to remember, when Roswell took place, he was the chief of staff of the Army. And so it would have gone up through the chain of command through Eisenhower. So he, by the time he became president, he already knew. I think that, and if I was Jimmy Carter and I was the president and I said to the CIA director, I'd like to see your UFO stuff, and the guy says to me, I'm sorry, you don't have a need to know, I'd say, you're fired, bring your deputy in. I'll ask him, and if he won't tell me, he's fired, and I'll keep going until I find somebody who will show me the stuff, because I'm the president and I can do that sort of thing. So the idea that the president can't get to the information, I find a little bit difficult to believe, simply because he has the power to do it. I also think that it's not a priority briefing item for the president, so that when you're elected president, they don't give you a big UFO briefing, because there's a lot of other stuff you need to deal with on a priority basis. For example, if you're President Barack Obama coming in, one of the things you're going to have to know is what's going on in Iraq, what's going on in Afghanistan, and what's the situation with terrorism, what's the situation with the economy. All these things take precedent first before you can get down to UFOs, which I think in today's environment is sort of one of those nice-to-know sorts of things. So I think we have to look at it in context of history and what goes on around that. I do know that there have been operations that were conducted without the knowledge of the president, but when the president needed the information, he was brought into it. And I'm thinking specifically of Operation Solo, which was two guys, two brothers, Morris Childs was the older of the two, who had been communists in the 1930s and became confidants in the Soviet Union, but they were working for the FBI. And the operation was run out of New York, and agents in the New York office didn't even know what was going on because they needed to keep it so secret, because if anything got out, these guys would be assassinated the moment they got to the Soviet Union. They told President Ford about it because he had just become president. He was going to meet with the Soviets, and he just wasn't confident enough of the information until so they brought him in and let him know what was going on. Childs retired in the 1990s. He was, and after the Soviet Union collapsed, he was given an award by the CIA for his lifetime of work. So those sorts of things do take place. But if the president asks, I've always believed the president has the power to learn what he wants to know.
I was going to say, of all the presidents, which one do you think had the most inside knowledge? Nixon?
I would go back to the earlier guys. I would think that Truman and Eisenhower, because both of them were involved in the case when Roswell happened in 1947. Truman because he was president, and Eisenhower because he was the chief of staff of the army.
And in those days, they really didn't hold things back from presidents, did they? Like they do now.
Well, again, I think it is a matter of priorities and what the president needs to know to do his job. And there's a lot of stuff that he needs to know to do his job. And I think of the UFOs. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a threat to national security. There doesn't be a threat from alien invasion. So I think that's one of the things the president, if he wants to know something, he has to ask the questions. They're not going to brief him on it without some kind of direction from him. So a president may not be that interested in it and may not ask the proper questions.
The 1997 Phoenix Lights story, we'll talk about that, Kevin, when we come back and take final phone calls here in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with our special guest, Kevin Randall, his website blog linked up at coasttocoastam.com. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk the first hour about whales. Incredible stories about whales, followed by John Rhodes, the crypto hunter. So make sure you're part of that Coast to Coast program. Friday night, the program will originate live from Portland because I'm going to be at the major UFO fest in McMinnville, which you can get full details at our calendar section at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back. Final segment with Kevin Randall. Kevin, abductions, have you looked at that phenomenon and trying to ascertain what the heck is going on there?
I have looked at that. I think the explanation is basically terrestrial. I know that I think I reported on the first case where it was the aliens were reported to have come into the house, which was the Pat Roach abduction in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
Others have come forward and said they have had the bedroom invasions earlier in that, but I think it was the first time it was ever reported as an article I did for the old Saga UFO report. I now suspect that case, and I always hesitate to do this, but I say that specific case I think was an episode of sleep paralysis. I think that's the explanation for that specific case, which does not mean that all cases are sleep paralysis. It means that specific case. I do think that if you've got an abduction phenomenon going on, it more closely would be like Barney and Betty Hill or mm-hmm. Travis Walton, a one-time target of opportunity as opposed to the repeated abductions. You know, that's kind of my opinion on it, but that's, you know, where the abduction phenomenon has taken me.
What do you think of the crop formations? Hoax?
I don't really think that's related to UFOs. I know it's a subset and people, you know, I look at UFOs, I just don't think that's related. You know, again, my opinion based on the evidence that I have seen and the research that I have done.
Animal mutilations?
Same thing. I just don't think that's related to UFOs. It just doesn't make a lot of sense for it. I know Chris O'Brien and some of the people are absolutely convinced that there's an extraterrestrial component to it. I'm just not sure there is. You know, but I periodically revisit all these sorts of things to look at the latest state of the evidence to make sure that you know, nothing has changed in those phenomena, those subsets of UFOs, to alter my opinion. So, I'm not convinced completely that we have all the answers. It's just that this is where it seems to be going based on what I have seen.
Let's go to Anna in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Anna, thanks for holding so long. Go ahead.
Some years ago, I had a sighting that was absolutely life-changing. And rather describe that, I'll get to my point, that I think is the most telling. I had a cousin, a graduate of the Air Force Academy, a very high-ranking officer in the military stationed at the Pentagon. And after this sighting, I sent him an email describing the sighting in detail. That was the last time I ever heard from him. Changed his email address, his phone number, and never spoke to me again. So that raises my suspicions way high to the point where I'm wondering if he wasn't probably ordered to have no further communication. Or the sighting was phenomenal. I learned about it. My husband had a hobby of listening to police scanners, and he heard the surrounding police department speaking on the scanner about this object in the sky. And we went out and looked at it, and it was classic, with lights blinking in sequence from end to end that seemed to start at the left side, go to the right side, disappear for a while, pick up again on the right side. Multicolored square frames of light, blue, yellow, white. But I think the most telling is this cousin who was stationed in the Pentagon. Once I related that sighting to him, had no further contact with me.
And what about the rest of the family? Anybody ever find him?
The rest of the family knows, I'm sure his father and whatever know where he is, but it's just the idea that he never had contact with me after that.
Cut you off, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for that. I guess that happens, Kevin, in some cases.
Well, coincidentally, I was just reading today about the Portage County UFO chase in Ohio, where the deputies chased the UFO, a number of deputies, and within a year, none of them worked in law enforcement anymore because of the whole thing. The other side of that coin is when I went to Richard Schubauer Air Force Base as a young lieutenant, it came out that I had studied UFOs, and I'd written some articles critical of the Air Force investigation of it. In fact, as they were investigating me for my top secret clearance, the fellow who did the investigation happened to live across the street from my father and told him that they had put a number of the articles in the file. But I never had a problem getting the clearances. I always had a top secret clearance. It always came through. There didn't seem to be any ramifications for my UFO research on my military career. So, you know, that's kind of a bizarre story, but I've seen things on both ends of the spectrum. So it just doesn't make any sense to me. There was really, unless he is involved in some critical work that may be related to UFOs, that just really doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it doesn't. What do you think of the Men in Black situation?
That's kind of bizarre.
It is. Do you think it's happening?
I actually had written to John Keel, who was the one that kind of brought that phenomenon to the forefront,
right.
After Gray Barker.
And he's gone.
He wrote back and told me that he found the phenomenon reflective, which meant the more you worried about it, the more you investigated, the more prominent it became in your life. And if you just sort of forgot about it, it would go away and leave you alone. I did read Nick Redfern's book on the phenomenon of Men in Black, which was kind of an interesting read, especially some of the information he produced. And he actually had a picture of a man in black in his book. But that would seem to be, if you were, you know, you're talking about something that is demonic, that would seem to fit more into the demonic realm than it would be into the extraterrestrial realm. So it's just one of those bizarre things.
Have you ever been threatened, Kevin, by them?
I would think that I would be on the list, given what I've done and where I've been. But like I said, you know, I've never had a problem with my military career in that respect.
And knocking on your door.
No, I've had some strange people show up at my door, but that's a whole different story.
Yeah.
I've really not had any problems like that.
Next up, Sean in Prescott, Wisconsin. Sean, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Yes. Good morning, George.
Morning.
Good morning, Kevin.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Kevin's opinion on both backwards engineering and also what he thinks about John Teeter.
John Teeter, of course, was a supposed time traveler from 2034, Kevin, who came back here, started posting on internet, and needed to get a part from an old IBM computer, but made some pretty interesting predictions about civil unrest and things like that, some of which might be spot on. But time traveler, I do not know.
My question would be, why couldn't he, in the future, why couldn't they manufacture the part instead of having to come back to pick one up? What was the other part of the question? The first part?
Backwards engineering.
Oh, reverse engineering, yes. I've thought about this, that if they picked up the craft at Roswell, they would, of course, try to reverse engineer it.
Might not have been able to do that, though, right?
But that was what I was going to say. I think, you know, it's kind of like taking a videotape back to Merlin the Magician and you know, showing him the videotape. You get pictures and sound off it, but to understand it, you have to understand two things that are invisible, electricity and magnetism. And I think that the materials recovered at Roswell were so far advanced that we just don't have the technology to understand them at this point. So they may have given hints to them about some aspects of composite materials or something like that, but I haven't seen anything that really migrates into our society that would suggest there was a quantum leap in the knowledge and that sort of thing. So I'm thinking that they just haven't been able to reverse engineer anything that they have, but they would be attempting to do it. And as our technology improved, we would apply that technology to it to see if we could figure out what it was, how it worked.
Give some of our ancients a submarine and tell them, make one. There's no way.
Yeah, that's the point. Or you know, make a videotape. You know, here's a black ribbon. And if you know what you're doing, you can get pictures of sound off it. But you have to understand magnetism, and you have to understand
here's
electricity to do it.
Let's go to Mark.
Oh, yeah, smartphone.
I would love that. Westlake, Oregon. Mark, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, George, and good evening to you and Kevin.
You too.
Yes, sir. Kevin, I, you know, just being a layperson, I'm certainly not I haven't, nor do I research the UFO phenomena and its various aspects, in which it's been widely reported, different facets of it. And I think you addressed several, and I was just curious how you come to such broad conclusions of doubt. Not to cast aspersions here, Kevin, I'm just trying to understand your point of view. But in the one particular facet of abductions, there have been a tremendous amount of cases, a tremendous amount of physiological evidence to show that this is not anything that the public is privy to. At the very least, on a terrestrial level, it would be U.S. government experimentation. And that's been reported also, that there have been humanoids, at least, aboard the craft, and sometimes dressed in military-type uniforms. It gets very confusing, but just the number of cases of people who have been abducted and they have seen aliens, they have gone under physical examinations and been impregnated. There's the whole hybridization program that's been reported by witnesses, abductees. And it just really seems to me to be a very broad area of research because of the vast amount of evidence that has accumulated over the years. And beyond that, when it comes to the cattle mutilations, it's not just cattle, it's various animals, not just in this country, but around the world for many years now. And often the creature will be dropped from a fairly high level above the ground, and they show those signs of trauma to their bodies as they would hit the ground and show those signs of that from a high height. And when it comes to the actual procedures that have been used in order to excise certain parts from these animals and the blood that has been completely drained, there's not a drop of blood left in them, and that there are no tracks around the animals, that there's no approach or exit by anyone walking on the ground. This seems to me, again, Kevin, to really merit a more serious answer from you through your research in the future. But I just wanted to make you aware, sir, and I do respect you. I'm not, like I say, I don't want to be disrespectful here. You've done a lot of great research. But there's just a lot of evidence over many years that, you know, it really deserves being taken a look at.
All right, I'll let you react to that.
And my answer is I've taken a look at it. I've looked at it in depth. In fact, I was one of the first researchers that looked into the cattle mutilations. Jim Lorenzen from APRO called me one night at home and said they've had a series of mutilations in Minnesota. Would you go up there and take a look at it? So I did. So I looked at the cattle mutilations in depth. But if you look at the complexity of the UFO phenomenon, it's almost impossible for one person to do in-depth research on abductions, in-depth research on cattle mutilations, in-depth research on crash retrievals, in-depth research on photographic evidence, and all of that sort of thing. In my experience, I've seen things, I think it fits into the entire UFO phenomena where we say 95% of the UFO sightings are going to have a mundane or a terrestrial explanation. And I think that translates into these other phenomena as well, that a great number of the abductions are not extraterrestrial based, but there are some that are very persuasive. And the Esboas from Brazil is very interesting. The Barney and Betty Hill case is very interesting.
Great
Travis
case.
Walton is very interesting,
yep.
because of the way it happened. But there are other phenomena at play here, and you've got to understand that those things explain some of that phenomenon, and we have to get away from what we consider the noise, the cases that are not extraterrestrially based, and move toward those if we want to understand that aspect of it.
And I'm sure, you know, these missing cases, too, are baffling, Kevin, where people merely just disappear.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's any number of subsets of UFO phenomenon that we could look at. The crop circles, there's interesting stuff being done with the analysis of the plants and the cellular structure of them. But I think that there's also evidence that some of those crop circles have been hoaxed, and they show how it's hoaxed, and it seems to be simpler than we would think. So you've got some of that going on, which is not to say that everyone is hoaxed or anything like that. It's just we've got to look at all of that and bring the best cases forward.
As I've told our reporter Linda Moulton Howe, Kevin, I said, all you need is one real case. All the others could be fakes, but it's the one real one that's going to push you over the top.
And we have to be very careful when we move into this stuff, because if we embrace a case that turns out to be faked, that hurts the entire investigative process. We have to be very careful in what we do and very careful in what we say, and we have to be somewhat skeptical of these things until we can get a good body of evidence. And I think when we talk about UFOs, we have that body of evidence in a wide range. And when we move into some of these other things, we do not have the preponderance of evidence that we really need to hammer home the point. And so I tend to be careful on that.
Kevin, the calls keep rolling in, but so has the clock, and we are out of time. We do have that link for you on your website blog, and your books are still available, I trust.
Oh, absolutely. Go to Amazon, see if we can bump it up to number one.
That would be nice. Kevin, thanks. Let's talk again, okay?
I would love to. Thank you, George.
Kevin Randall, he's one of the greatest UFO investigators out there. And he looks at all the data and all the facts. You know, I'm puzzled by cattle mutilations, crop formations, abductions. They could all be tied in together. There's no doubt about that. Thanks again, Kevin. Always like you being on the program with us. For Dan Galante, Jonathan King, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonewood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.